papers and explained to Kate this was from the foyer carpet. I carefully pressed the sticky paper to the inside of the plastic bag and said, "One time, I swiped a murder suspect's ham sandwich from his kitchen." I began writing up the lint paper description and continued, "I got enough DNA to link him to the crime." But his lawyer argued that the evidence was improperly obtained, stolen, without a warrant, and therefore not admissible, and I had to swear that the suspect offered me the half-eaten sandwich. I rolled the bag up and asked Kate, "Do you have any tape?"
"No, but I'll get some." "So what happened?"
"To what?" "Oh, the evidence. So the defense attorney grills me about why the accused would offer me a half-eaten ham sandwich, and I'm on the stand for 20 minutes explaining how this happened and why I shoved the sandwich in my pocket instead of eating it." I smiled at the memory of that testimony. The judge was impressed with my bullshit and ruled the ham sandwich as admissible. I added, "The defense attorney went bonkers and accused me of lying."
"Well, but it was a lie, wasn't it?"
"It was a gray area." She didn't comment on that, but asked, "Did they get a conviction?" Justice was done. I found the hand towel in the bottom of the second bag and said to Kate, "This is from the downstairs pee-pee room, and I used this to wipe some surfaces." As I wrote a note about the hand towel, I said, "This comes under the category of the ham sandwich. Was I offered the hand towel to keep, or did I take it without a search warrant? What would you say?"
"It's not for me to say. It's for you to say."
"Right." I wrote on the note and said aloud, "Offered to me by Carl, an employee of the suspect, when he noticed it was..." "What? Stuck in my zipper?"
"You may have to think about that."
"Right. I'll finish this later. Okay, so with any luck, some of these hairs and fibers from Custer Hill will match those found on Harry. And similarly, maybe some of Harry's hair and clothing fibers were left at Custer Hill, and they'll be mixed in with this stuff." Kate had no comment except to say,
"Good job, John."
"Thank you." I informed her I was a good detective.
"You still are."
"Shucks." She said,
"I think we have enough forensic and other evidence now to call Tom Walsh, then get back to New York ASAP.
I ignored that suggestion and showed her my new wool socks. "We have another shot at collecting evidence from the lodge." I asked her, "What kind of socks do you have on?" She didn't reply to my question and instead asked me,
"Are you serious about that dinner invitation?"
"I am." I put the lint roller back in my pocket. "How many times does a murder suspect invite you to dinner?"
"Well, the Borges used to do it all the time."
"Yeah? They were... Gambino family, right?"
"No. They were Italian nobility who used to poison their dinner guests."
"Really? And the guests kept coming? That's pretty stupid."
"Point made."
She unwrapped the energy bar and I asked her, "Do you want me to take a bite to see if it's poisoned?"
"No, but if you're hungry, I'll share this with you."
"I'm saving my appetite for dinner."
"I'm not going there."
"Sweetheart, he specifically invited you."
"And you're not going either."
She said to me,
"Tell me what you and Maddox talked about."
"Okay, but first, call Wilma."
"Why?"
"Tell her you'll get her laptop back to her before 6:30 and ask her for a roll of tape."
"Okay."
She moved to the desk and I walked barefoot to the couch, not wanting to taint my new socks with Wilma's B&B. Kate picked up the phone and I said to her, "Also, ask Wilma to call you immediately if your husband drives by in the white Hyundai." I thought Kate would tell me I was an infantile idiot, but she smiled and said,
"Okay."
She had an odd sense of humor. Kate called and got Wilma on the phone and thanked her for the laptop and promised to return it before 6:30. Then Kate said,
"Could I impose on you for two more favors? I need a roll of tape. masking tape or duct tape. I'm happy to pay you for it.
Thank you.
Oh, and if you see my husband drive by in the white Hyundai, could you call me immediately?
Kate smiled as Wilma said something. Kate explained,
it's just a friend, but... well, yes.
Tell her you need enough tape for your wrists and ankles, and see if she has whipped cream.
Hold on, please.
She covered the phone and, suppressing a laugh, said to me,
John.
And call us if any other vehicle is headed for Pond House. Kate looked at me again, nodded, and said to Wilma,
my husband may be driving another vehicle. So if you see any vehicle coming toward Pond House,
yes, thank you.
Kate hung up and said to me,
Wilma suggests that my friend move his van and reminded me that there's a back door off the porch.
We both got a good chuckle out of that, which is what we needed. Kate said,
as if I don't know how to get rid of a guy out the back door.
Hey. She smiled, then said seriously,
I guess Wilma is now our lookout.
She's motivated. Kate nodded.
Sometimes you think good.
I'm motivated. Anyway, we belatedly hugged and kissed, then Kate informed me,
I booked us a flight to LaGuardia from Syracuse at 8:30 a.m. tomorrow. That was the first available flight I could get.
I didn't want to argue about that at this point. I hope you didn't use your credit card.
They weren't taking checks over the phone.
Well, when you get to the airport, tell Liam Griffith I said hello.
John, they can't get credit card information that fast.
Well,
we can drive to Toronto tonight. There are lots of flights to New York and Newark from Toronto.
We are not crossing an international border. I asked, okay, how'd you make out? She opened a notebook on the desk.
All right.
First, as I said, I couldn't reach Major Schaefer. I called twice and left messages that I'd call him again. But I don't think he wants to talk to me. You may have better luck.
I'll call him later. I lay on the couch and said, there was no visible stakeout team at McEwen Pond Road.
Maybe they were concealed.
Maybe. But maybe Schaefer pulled the plug on us.
But you went in anyway.
I carved a note on a birch tree. She continued,
I went through the flight manifest, airline reservation sheets, and car rental agreements. There were no startling names that popped out, except Paul Dunn and Edward Wolfer. And, of course, Mikhail Putyov.
She glanced at her notes and continued,
there were a few other names that sounded familiar, but maybe that's because I'm reading into these names.
She added,
for instance, James Hawkins. Does that sound familiar to you?
And don't tell me he played third base for the Yankees.
Okay, he didn't.
Hawkins. Did you Google him?
I did. There is a James Hawkins on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Air Force General. But I can't tell if this is the same guy.
Well, if he went to the Custer Hill Club, it probably is. Did he rent a car?
No. He arrived from Boston on Saturday at 9:25 a.m. and departed on the 12:45 p.m. flight back to Boston on Sunday, connecting to Washington.
Okay. If he went to Custer Hill, he was probably picked up by the van. I added, it's interesting that Maddox didn't send his corporate jets for any of these VIPs. But I guess he and they probably didn't want that direct connection between them. And that's always a little suspicious. Kate replied,
often it's just a matter of government officials not accepting costly gifts or favors from rich people. It's an ethical issue.
That's even more suspicious. I said, so Maddox may also have had a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at his gathering.
Air Force General. I wonder if these guests knew Harry was there, and what happened to him.
I couldn't imagine that people like that would be complicit in a murder. On the other hand, if the stakes were high enough, anything was possible. What else on the airport info?
That's it. As for the dozens of other names, we'll need a team to work that list to see who these people are and what, if any, connection any of them might have to Bain Maddox.
I said, I hope our colleagues are already working on that. But we'll never know the results. She didn't comment on that and said instead, then I went online and Googled Mr. Bain Maddox, and there's surprisingly little on him. That's not so surprising.
I guess not.
Most of what I found were corporate facts. His position as CEO and principal shareholder of Global Oil Corporation. And not much on that. Also, very little in the way of biography. Almost nothing personal. No mention of his ex-wife or children. Only a half dozen quotes from published sources, and not a single unpublished quote or comment from anyone. Apparently, he's able to get blogs and other third-party information deleted.
Apparently.
She glanced at her notes and went on. The only thing vaguely interesting is that about 50% of his oil and gas holdings and half his tanker fleet are owned by unnamed interests in the Middle East.
I thought about that, and what Maddox had just said about his Iraqi oil minister buddy during my chat with him. This meant that, like most Western oil executives, he had to kiss some ass in Sandland. But since Bain Maddox did not seem like the ass-kissing type, he might be planning a way to eliminate his partners, forever and ever. Maybe that's what this was about. Kate continued, I then went online and researched ELF. She informed me, there's not much more than what John Nassif told us, except that the Russians use their ELF system differently than we do.
Right. They have more letters in their alphabet. I yawned and listened to my stomach growl.
There's another difference. She looked at her notes again. Listen to this. The U.S., as we discovered, sends ELF messages to the nuclear subfleet as a bell ringer. But the Russians, during times of heightened tensions, send a continuous message to their nuclear submarines that, in effect, says, all is well. When the positive message stops, that means there's a new, urgent message on the way. And if that message doesn't arrive within the time it would take for an ELF signal to reach the submarines, then the silence is taken to mean the ELF station has been destroyed, and the subs are then authorized to launch against their pre-designated targets in the U.S., or China, or wherever.
Geez, I hope they're paying their electric bills on time.
Me too.
Kate continued, this is why our ELF receiver in Greenland was able to hone in on the Russian ELF signal on the Kola Peninsula, because they were using this continuous all-is-well signal during a period of heightened tensions, which, according to this article, we precipitated in order to get the Russians to switch to their continuous message system, which in turn enabled us to find their ELF transmitter on the Kola Peninsula.
Wow, aren't we clever? And talk about nuclear brinkmanship. Aren't we glad the Cold War is over?
Yes, but this got me thinking that Maddox, who had once obtained American ELF codes, may have obtained the Russian ELF codes. She informed me, according to this article, written by a Swede, incidentally, Russian encryption software is not as sophisticated or impenetrable as ours, so it could be that Maddox has changed his ELF frequency to the frequency used by the Russians, and he's going to try to send false signals to the Russian subfleet to nuke China or the Mideast or whoever he doesn't like these days.
I thought about that. I guess if the Russian codes are easier to penetrate than ours, that's a possibility. I added, same Custer Hill ELF transmitter, different nuclear submarines. Any more interesting ELF stuff?
Just that the Indians are looking to build an ELF station?
I sat up on the couch and asked, what the hell do they need that for?
Launching tomahawks?
They have the casinos, for God's sake.
John, the India Indians.
Oh.
They're developing a nuclear submarine fleet. So are the Chinese and the Pakistanis.
That sucks. Next it'll be the postal workers. Then we can kiss our asses goodbye. Kate informed me,
Actually, the world is becoming a far more dangerous place than it was during the Cold War when it was just us and them.
Right. What's the median price of a house in Potsdam? She didn't seem to recall and sat at the desk, lost in thought. Then she said,
I also discovered some not good news.
Like bad news?
Yes.
What?
I'm still trying to sort it out. Let's finish the rest of what we need to discuss first, so we have a context.
Is your mother coming to visit?
This is not a joke.
All right. What's next?
Mikhail Putyov.
Chapter 42.
Mikhail Putyov, I said. No sign of him at Custer Hill. How about his home or office?
I called his office first, and his secretary, Ms. Crabtree, said he wasn't in.
So I said I was a doctor and this concerned a serious health matter.
That's a good one.
I never used that.
It works every time. Anyway, Ms. Crabtree loosened up a bit and told me that Dr. Putyov hadn't shown up at work, hadn't called, and that her calls to his cell phone went right into voicemail. She had also called Putyov's wife, but Mrs. Putyov did not know where her husband was. Kate added, obviously, Putyov never told anyone where he was going.
Did you get Putyov's cell phone number?
No. Ms. Crabtree wouldn't give it to me, but she gave me hers for after hours, and I gave her my beeper number.
Kate added, Ms. Crabtree sounded concerned. Okay. So Mikhail is AWOL from MIT. How about home?
Same. Mrs. Putyov was on the verge of tears.
She said that even when Mikhail is with his mistress, he calls and makes an excuse for not coming home. He's a good husband.
John, don't be an asshole.
Just kidding. So Mikhail is not just AWOL. He's missing in action.
Well, he is as far as his wife and secretary are concerned, but he's probably still at the Custer Hill Club.
I shook my head. If he was, he'd have called. A man in his situation, with FBI chaperones, doesn't disappear and put his wife, family, or office in a position to think about calling the FBI. That's the last thing Putyov wants.
Kate nodded, then asked,
So? Well, I said, apparently, not everyone who walks into the Custer Hill Club leaves in the same condition as when they arrived.
Apparently not.
She pointed out, You've been there twice. Want to try again?
Third time's a charm.
She ignored that and continued,
So I googled Putyov Mikhail and pulled up some published articles and unpublished pieces that other physicists had written about him.
Do they like him?
They respect him. He's a star in the world of nuclear physics.
That's nice. Then why is he hanging around Bain Maddox?
There could be a professional relationship,
although for all we know, it could be some sort of personal relationship.
Maybe they're just friends.
Then why didn't he tell his wife where he was going?
That's the question.
Anyway, all we know for sure is that a nuclear physicist named Mikhail Putyov was a guest at the Custer Hill Club and is now missing. Anything beyond that is speculation.
Right.
Hey, did you call the point?
Yes.
There were two new messages from Liam Griffith saying it was urgent that we contact him.
Urgent for who?
Not us. Did you say we were shopping from moose heads in Lake Placid?
I told Jim at the front desk to tell anyone who calls that we are expected back at the point for dinner.
Good. That might keep Griffith cooled off until he shows up at the point and discovers he got snookered. I asked, Did Walsh call?
No.
See? Our boss cut us loose.
Nice guy. I think we cut him loose, John, and now he's returning the favor.
Whatever. Screw him. Who else called?
Major Schaefer called the point, as per your suggestion.
His message to you was, Your car has been returned to the point. Keys with front desk.
That's nice.
He forgot to leave the stakeout team in place, but he didn't forget to cover his butt with the FBI.
Did anyone ever tell you that you were cynical?
Sweetheart, I was an NYPD cop for 20 years. I'm a realist. I reminded her, I think we've been through this before. Okay, what else? She dropped her favorite subject and continued, a man named Carl, sounds familiar, called and left a message that said, dinner is on. Jim asked for the details, but Carl said that Mr. Corey already had the details, and please bring Ms. Mayfield as discussed. She added, so Maddox wasn't leaving his name, or anything that could connect our disappearance to him or his lodge. What disappearance? Our disappearance. Why are you so suspicious of people? John, fuck off. She continued, we also had 3 voicemail messages in our room. Griffith and who else? Kate referred to her notes. Liam Griffith at 3:49 said, cheerily, hi guys. Thought I'd see you earlier. Give me a call when you get this. Hope all is well. I laughed and said, what an asshole. How stupid does he think we are? I quickly added, sorry, that sounded cynical. Second voicemail asking if we'd like to schedule a massage. Yes. Last voicemail from Henri, who sounds cute, asking what type of mustard you'd like with your pigs in the blanket. See? You didn't believe me. John, we have more pressing matters to deal with than... Did you call him back? I did, to keep up the pretext that we were returning to the point. What did you tell Henry? Deli mustard, right? I did. He's very charming. He wanted to show me his woodcock. She ignored that. I also made a massage appointment for both of us tomorrow morning. Good. I'm looking forward to that. We're not going to be there. This is true. Well, I'm sorry to disappoint Henry after all the trouble he went to, but I'm not sorry to miss cocktails with Liam Griffith. Kate looked a little fatigued, or maybe worried, and I needed to give her a pep talk, so I said, you did a great job. You're the best partner I've ever had. I'm your boss. Right. Best boss I've ever had. Okay, so, the FAA. The phone rang, and I said to Kate, you expecting a call? No. Maybe it's Wilma. Your husband is on the way. She hesitated, then answered the phone. Hello? She listened, then said, thank you. Yes. I'll tell him. Thanks. She hung up. It was Wilma. Duct tape is outside our door. She says my friend should move his van. We both laughed, but clearly we were on edge. I went to the window, checked out the terrain, then opened the door and retrieved a big roll of duct tape. I sat at the kitchen table and began wrapping the makeshift evidence bags, as per rules and regulations. I said to her, tell me about the FAA. She didn't reply and instead asked me, why don't we just get the Hyundai back from Rudy, take those evidence bags, and drive to New York? Do you have a pen? I need to sign this tape. We could be at 26 Fed at about... She looked at her watch and said, about 3 or 4 in the morning. You can go. I'm staying here. This is where it's happening, and this is where I need to be. Pen, please. She handed me a pen from her bag. What is happening? I don't know, but when it happens, I'll be here. I signed the tape and said, actually, we should split up in case... Okay, you drive Rudy's van to Messina, rent another car, and drive to New York. She sat on the chair beside me, took my hand, and said, let me finish telling you what I've learned, then we'll decide what to do. This sounded like she had an ace up her sleeve, which was probably the bad news. Whatever it was pressing on her mind. I said, the FAA. Bad news? The good news is that I was able to get some information. The bad news is the information. Chapter 43 The FAA, Kate began.
As you predicted, this was a challenge. But finally, someone at the FAA clued me in to call the Regional Flight Service Station, the FSS, in Kansas City, where these two GOCO aircraft arrived Sunday afternoon from Adirondack Regional Airport.
Good. What did the FSS in KC say?
Well, they said these two aircraft landed, refueled, and filed continuing flight plans, then departed.
She glanced at her notes.
One Cessna Citation, piloted by Captain Tim Black, with tail number N2730G, flew to Los Angeles. The other, piloted by Captain Elwood Bellman, with tail number N2731G, flew to San Francisco.
Really?
That sort of surprised me. I was sure that one or both of Maddox's jets would fly back here to Adirondack Regional Airport, where Maddox could hop aboard and go wherever he needed to go in a hurry.
And those were their final destinations?
As of about an hour ago. I called the FSS in L.A. and San Francisco, and no new flight plans have been filed.
Okay. But why did they fly to Los Angeles and San Francisco?
That's what we need to find out.
Right. We also should find out where the pilots are staying in these cities so we can talk to them.
I had the same thought, and I discovered that private aircraft use what's called fixed base operations, FBOs, to take care of arriving and departing aircraft. At LAX, I discovered that GOCO aircraft use Garrett Aviation Service as its FBO, and at SFO, GOCO aircraft use a company called Signature Flight Support. So I called these FBOs and asked if they knew where the GOCO pilots and co-pilots might be. I was told that sometimes a pilot leaves a local number, usually a hotel, where they can be contacted if needed, or their cell phone numbers. But not this time. The only contact information that these FBOs had on the pilots was the GOCO flight department at Stewart International Airport in Newburgh, New York, where GOCO has its base operations, maintenance hangar, and dispatch office.
And? You called these people?
Yes, I called the GOCO dispatch office at Stewart, but for obvious reasons, I did not identify myself as FBI, and no one would give me any information on the two crews.
Did you tell them you were a doctor and that both pilots and co-pilots are legally blind?
No, but I'll let you call and see what you can find out.
Maybe later. I asked, what are the names of the co-pilots?
Oddly, the flight plans don't ask for the name of the co-pilot.
I could see that the Federal Aviation Administration hadn't tightened up its act regarding private aviation since 9/11. But I already knew that.
Kate said, the flight plan does show the number of persons on board, and both aircraft had two, pilot and co-pilot.
Okay. So these aircraft landed at LAX and SFO. No passengers, and they've been parked there since Sunday night, and there are no new flight plans filed. And I assume Captain Black and Captain Bellman and their unidentified co-pilots are enjoying the sights of L.A. and San Francisco as they await further instructions.
It would seem so.
I thought about all of this and concluded that maybe it had no meaning and was perfectly normal. Just four pilots jetting across the continent without passengers, burning jet fuel at the rate of several hundred gallons per hour, while their boss transported more fuel into the country in his tankers. I asked Kate, does this seem strange to you?
In and of itself, maybe yes, but we don't know this world.
She informed me, one of the FBO employees in San Francisco, for instance, suggested that maybe these aircraft had been chartered by someone for a pickup in San Francisco. Do you think a man like Maddox charters his personal jets to make a few bucks?
Apparently some rich people do, but there's more.
I hoped there was.
Kate continued, I spoke to a Ms. Carol Ascrisi, who works for Signature Flight Support in San Francisco, and she told me she was asked to transport the pilot and co-pilot in the courtesy van to the taxi line at the main terminal.
This didn't seem unusual or important, but I could tell by Ms. Mayfield's tone of voice that it was. And?
And Ms. Escrezy said that GoCo, like most bigger companies, almost always books a car and driver ahead of time to take the flight crew wherever they need to go. Therefore, she found it odd that this pilot and co-pilot needed to take a taxi from the main terminal. So, Ms. Escrezy, wanting to be nice to good customers, told me she offered to drive the two guys to their hotel. Kate informed me, apparently these crews usually stay in some place with corporate rates near the airport. But the co-pilot told her thanks, but they were going downtown, and they'd take a taxi.
Okay. Did she know where they were going?
No, they didn't say.
Which, I thought, could be why they were taking a taxi and not the offered courtesy van, and why there was no livery car waiting for them. All right. Anything else?
Yes. She told me that these two guys, pilot and co-pilot, had two large black leather trunks with them. The trunks were padlocked, and they were on wheels, and they were very heavy, and it took both men to get each trunk into the van.
Okay. Big and heavy. Padlock and wheels. I said, I guess that was the cargo that Chad saw at the airport here. Now it's been offloaded in San Francisco, and I assume L.A. also. Kate wasn't bringing this information to any point, so I mentioned helpfully, maybe the men had their wives or girlfriends on board as stowaways, and these big heavy trunks held 2 days of clothes for the ladies. She inquired, how did you manage to get a sexist remark into a conversation about aircraft cargo? Sorry, it wasn't easy. I was just speculating. I further speculated, so, gold? Two dead bodies? What?
You should think about it.
Okay. What did Carol Escrezy say? Was she suspicious? Did the pilot and co-pilot act suspicious and nervous?
The pilot and co-pilot, according to Ms. Escrezy, were perfectly normal and joked about the weight of the trunks and the fact that GoCo hadn't booked a car and driver for them. The co-pilot flirted with Ms. Escrezy and told her he hoped he'd see her Wednesday when they returned to the airport for their departure.
Okay. Departure to where?
The co-pilot said their final destination was LaGuardia, but he didn't say what stops they'd make en route. The pilot left instructions at Signature Flight Support to have the aircraft ready for a noon departure on Wednesday with full fuel.
All right. So the pilot and co-pilot, according to Ms. Escrezy, seemed normal, but the cargo did not. I thought about that and said, so the cargo was flown to L.A. and San Francisco in two private jets, rather than one jet, making two stops in those nearby cities.
That's correct.
And there was no car and driver to take the crew and this cargo to where they needed to go.
Correct.
And the pilot instructed Signature Flight Support in San Francisco to have the aircraft ready for a noon Wednesday departure with the final destination of LaGuardia, but from what you said, they hadn't yet filed a flight plan with the FAA.
Correct. But that's not unusual. Flight plans, I discovered,
need to be filed near the time of departure to take into account current weather, airport traffic, and so forth. That's logical.
Sorry I couldn't feed your paranoia.
Oh, don't worry about that. I got more where that came from. In fact, here's one. The pilot and co-pilot's secret destination in San Francisco.
Why secret?
Well, there was no hired car and driver, which would leave a paper trail. Plus, they passed up the opportunity to take the courtesy van into town after loading these trunks full of bricks or something into the van, which then had to be offloaded at the taxi line, then loaded into two taxis because of the size of the trunks for the trip into town. Does that make sense?
No.
So I called Garrett Aviation Service at LAX and got a guy named Scott on the phone, who asked around while I was on hold, and he got back to me with pretty much the same story. Two big black trunks and the courtesy van only to the taxi line. Ah, So apparently these four guys had the same instructions, to take taxis to wherever they were going with those trunks.
It would seem that way.
So, quite obviously, these two flight crews had a secret destination or destinations in L.A. and San Francisco, and that's why they each took a taxi, which would take a lot of luck to trace. Now the question is, does this have anything to do with Bane Maddox's insane plan to become Emperor of North America, or whatever the hell he's up to? Or is it not relevant?
I think it's relevant.
Is this the bad news? She replied, "We need more context. Now, you tell me about your conversation with Maddox." "Okay. Then I get the bad news."
"Yes.
Unless you can figure it out yourself before we're finished with the other items on the agenda."
"That's a challenge."
"Okay. Do I have everything I need to figure out the bad news?"
"You're at the point where I was when I figured it out.
Then I found one more piece of information that confirmed what I was afraid of."
"Okay. Wow."
I thought about that, and there was something coming together in my brain. But before it fell into place, Kate said,
"You're on.
Custer Hill. Bane Maddox." All roads lead back to Custer Hill and Bane Maddox. Chapter 44. I sat back on the couch and Kate sat in an easy chair. I said, "All right." First, Bane Maddox was half expecting me. I added, "Great minds think alike." I love it when she rolls her eyes. It's so cute. I continued, "The house staff seems to be gone, but the security guards are there, and so is Carl." I gave Kate a short briefing of my time with Bane Maddox, including the tangential discussions about being wounded in the line of duty and Maddox's odd obsession with bears. I said to her, "But maybe these topics were not tangential. Maddox may have been speaking allegorically."
"Sounds more like macho bullshit to me."
"Right. That too. More important, I put Mr. Bane Maddox on official notice that he was a material witness in a suspected homicide. I explained my bogus suspicions about one of his security guards being Harry's killer. So now we have him in a tight spot." Kate reminded me, "Murdering a federal agent is not a federal crime." "Well, it should be.
But it's not."
She informed me, "New York State has the jurisdiction. That means Major Schaefer." She asked, "Don't you teach that in your class at John Jay College of Criminal Justice?" "Yes, I teach it. I don't practice it. Actually, I covered myself by using the word assault, which is a federal crime." I added, "Maddox is not a lawyer. He's a suspect."
"But he has a lawyer."
"Don't sweat the small stuff." She looked a little exasperated with me, but conceded,
"I guess that was a good move.
Is that about the time he asked you to dinner?"
"Actually, it was."
I added, "He'll have some of the information that I asked for tonight."
"Yeah, right.
Well, now you need to officially notify Major Schaefer and Tom Walsh of what you did."
"I will."
"When?"
"Later."
I continued to fill in more of what Maddox and I spoke about. But I didn't mention that a moment had come when I considered a classically simple solution to a complex problem. I wanted to say to my wife and partner, just as Maddox had solved his Harry Muller problem with a half ounce of lead, I could have resolved the entire Maddox problem in less time than it took to pick the lint off the rug. But I didn't say that. I did say, however, Maddox expressed his condolences about Harry, though he couldn't remember Harry's name. Kate looked at me. I said, Maddox wanted to know if there was a fund he could contribute to. She kept looking at me, and I think she suspected that I'd thought about expedited justice, used now and then in cases of cop killers. Kate said to me,
"I called Harry's girlfriend, Lori Bonick."
This took me by surprise, but I realized I should have done that by now.
"That was nice of you." It wasn't an easy conversation, but I assured her we were doing everything possible to get to the bottom of this.
I nodded.
Lori said to say hello to you. She's glad that it's you on the case.
Did you tell her I wasn't on the case any longer?
No, I did not.
Kate stared at me and said,
"Last I heard, you and I were on the case."
We made eye contact and exchanged brief smiles. I switched subjects. Well, bottom line with Bane Maddox is that he is now feeling pressed, and he may do something stupid, desperate, or clever.
I think he's already done all three by inviting you to dinner.
Us, darling. And I think you're right.
I know I'm right.
So why don't you just play right into his hands and show up? Or do something more clever, like don't show up. She asked, "May I call Tom Walsh now?" I ignored that and continued my briefing. I also got a good look at Maddox's back lot from his second-story office window. I informed her, "There's a barracks there big enough to hold 20 or 30 men, but I imagine not more than half are on duty at any time. Plus, there's a stone building with 3 chimneys belching smoke, and a diesel generator service truck parked outside." She nodded and said again,
"It may be time to share this information. I'll call Tom. You call Major Schaefer."
"All right. I'll call Hank Schaefer first, so we'll have more things to chat about with Tom Walsh." I stood and went to the desk phone, and using my phone debit card, I called State Police Headquarters in Raybrook. Major Schaefer was in for Detective Corey, and he asked me, "Where are you?" I hit the speaker button and replied, "I'm not sure, but I'm looking at a menu in French." Major Schaefer wasn't amused. "Did you get my message that your Hertz car was at the point?"
"I did, thank you."
He informed me, "Your friend Liam Griffith is not happy with you."
"Fuck him."
"Should I pass that on?"
"I'll do it myself. By the way, I went to the Custer Hill Club, and there was no visible stake out there."
"Well," he replied, "they were there. I pulled them back to Route 56 because this black Jeep kept snooping around. I have another team on the logging road in case anyone comes in or out from the back roads."
"Okay."
I inquired, "Anything new with your surveillance team?" "No one has arrived at the Custer Hill Club, except you in a white Enterprise rental Hyundai, and also a diesel service truck." He gave me the details of my arrival and departure and asked me, "What the hell were you doing there?"
"I'll get to that.
Has the diesel service truck left yet?"
"Not as of 5 minutes ago. No one else has left the subject property, so I guess this guy Putyov is still there."
He asked me, "Did you see any sign of him there?"
"No, I didn't."
I asked him, "Was I followed after I left the Custer Hill Club?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because I was called directly by my surveillance car, who told me it was an Enterprise rental, and the renter was a Mr. John Corey, and I told them you were on the job."
"Okay. So, if that was true, then the state police hadn't seen the vehicle switch at Rudy's gas station. If it wasn't true, then I was driving around in a hot van. But that only mattered if I didn't trust Major Schaefer, and the jury was out on that. Bottom line, I really think I would have noticed if I'd been followed." Major Schaefer inquired again, "What were you doing there?"
"I was sizing up the suspect and collecting forensic evidence."
"What kind of forensic evidence?"
"Hairs and carpet fibers." I explained what I'd done.
Major Schaefer listened, then asked, "Where is this evidence now?"
"In my possession."
"When are you giving it to me?"
"Well, I think there's a jurisdictional question that needs to be resolved first."
"No, there isn't. Murder is a state crime."
I reminded him, "You haven't classified it as a murder."
There was silence as Major Schaefer contemplated the consequences of his fence straddling. Finally, he said,
"I could arrest you for withholding evidence."
"You could, if you could find me."
"I can find you."
"No, I'm really good at this." I said,
I'll think about what's best for this investigation, and best for me and my partner. Don't think too long. He asked me, what did Maddox have to say? We talked about bears. I informed Major Schaefer. I put Bane Maddox on notice that he was a material witness in a possible homicide investigation. I explained how I did that and concluded, now he needs to cooperate, voluntarily or involuntarily, and that also puts some heat on him. Schaefer replied, yeah, I understand how that works, Detective. Thank you. He asked me, when did murder in New York State become a federal crime? When did Harry Muller's death become a murder? Clearly, Major Schaefer was not happy with me or my methods, so he didn't answer my question, but informed me, Maddox may now have to cooperate in the investigation, but you'll never see him again without his lawyer present. I wondered if Maddox's lawyer was coming to dinner. On that subject, I decided not to tell Schaefer about Maddox inviting me to dinner until I was well on my way to Custer Hill. I mean, I needed him to know where I was in case there was a problem, but I didn't want him to know about it too early in case he or Griffith became part of the problem by arresting me. He said, okay, I've done you some favors and you've done me some favors. I think we're even on favors. Actually, I have a few more favors to ask of you. Put them in writing, and then I'll owe you a favor. No reply. I think he was pissed. Nevertheless, I said, speaking of diesels, did you ever find out how big those diesel generators are at Custer Hill? Why is that important? I don't know that it is. I'm sure it's not. But I saw that building there. Yeah, I saw it too when I was hunting there. I let a few seconds pass, then he said, I had one of my men call Potsdam Diesel, but my guy got the information wrong, or their office person didn't read the file right. Meaning? Well, my guy said they told him the generators put out 2,000 kilowatts. He paused, then said, each. Hell, that could power a small town. It must be 20 kilowatts, maybe 200 tops, or maybe 20,000 watts. Is there a difference? There is if you stick your dick in a light socket. He dropped that subject and said to me, let me give you some advice. Okay. You're not in business for yourself. This is a team effort. Rejoin the team. Kate raised her hand in a seconding motion. I said to Major Schaefer, it's a little late for that. You and your wife should get over to headquarters now. It's always nice to be invited home again, and it's tempting, but I didn't trust my family any longer, so I said, I think you have all the federal agents you need there. He offered, I'll meet you someplace that'll make you feel safer. Okay, I'll let you know where to meet us later. Before he could respond, I hung up and looked at Kate, who said, John, I think we should go to... End of discussion. New topic. Potsdam Diesel. I picked up the phone and dialed Potsdam Diesel, whose phone number I recalled from their service truck. A young lady answered, Potsdam Diesel, this is Luann, how can I help you? I hit the speaker button. Hi, Luann. This is Joe, the caretaker at the Custer Hill Club. Yes, sir. I have Al here servicing the generators. Is there a problem? No, but could you pull the sales and service files for me? Hold on. The speaker started playing Muzak, and I said to Kate, I'm not current on watts. No pun intended. But Schaefer wasn't believing 6,000. What were they called? Megawatts? Kate replied, kilowatts. 1,000 watts is a kilowatt. 6,000 kilowatts is 6,000,000 watts. A light bulb is usually 75 watts. Wow, that's a lot of... Luann was back. I have it. How can I help you?
Well, if I lost power and the generators kicked in, could I make toast and coffee in the morning?
She laughed and said,
You could make toast and coffee for Potsdam. Yeah? So how many kilowatts do I have? Okay, you have 3 Detroit brand 16-cylinder diesel engines, each capable of driving its matching generator to 2,000 kilowatts. Kate and I exchanged glances. I said to Luann, no kidding. How old are these generators? Is it time to replace them? No. They were installed in 1984, but they should last forever with service. But how much is a new one? I'm not sure, but the cost of these in 1984 was $245,000. Each? Yes, each. Today? Well, a lot more. She asked me, is there a problem with the service? No. Al's doing a great job. I can see him sweating from here. When is he going to be finished? Well, we only have Al and Kevin. This was called in Saturday afternoon, and we're real busy. You know you're paying on an expedited basis. Kate and I again glanced at each other. I said to Luann, no problem. In fact, add $1,000 to Mr. Maddox's bill for Al and Kevin.
That's very generous of you.
So what do you think? Another hour?
I don't know.
Do you want me to call them, or do you want to go talk to them? You call them. Look, we're having a big dinner party, so maybe they can come back another time.
When would you like to schedule that?
November 31st.
Okay. Oh, I see here there's only 30 days in...
I'll call you on that. Meanwhile, give these guys a holler and tell them to knock off. I'll hold.
Hold on, please.
The phone started playing the Blue Danube Waltz for some reason, and I said to Kate, I should have done this an hour ago.
Better late than not at all.
She added, 6,000 kilowatts. Right. Why am I listening to the Blue Danube Waltz?
You're on hold.
Do you want to dance? Luann came back on the line and said, well, I have good news. They're finished and they're packing their tools. Great.
Shit. Is there anything else I can do for you?
Pray for world peace.
Okay. That's nice.
Luann, you have a good evening.
You too, Joe.
I hung up and said to Kate, in the history of the world, this is the first time a service crew finished ahead of schedule.
Maddox wasn't going to let those guys leave anyway. So if we weren't convinced that we were looking at an ELF antenna, that information should convince us.
I was already convinced. This is the clincher. I added, if you notice the silverware glowing tonight, let me know.
John, we are not going.
What is the downside of going there for dinner?
Death, dismemberment, disappearance, and divorce.
We can handle that.
I have a better idea. Let's get in that van and drive to Manhattan. Now, we'll call Tom on the way.
Forget it. I am not going to be on the fucking thruway talking to Tom Walsh on my cell phone while the shit is hitting the fan right here. In fact, the real reason we're going to the Custer Hill Club tonight is not dinner, or to gather more evidence, but to determine if we can and should place Mr. Bane Maddox under arrest for the murder of, sorry, the assault on Federal Agent Harry Muller. She thought about that, then replied,
I don't think we have enough evidence, or probable cause to...
Fuck the evidence. We have the evidence. It's in those bags. And the probable cause is the sum total of everything we've seen and heard. She shook her head and said,
an arrest on any federal charge, especially of a man like Bane Maddox, would be premature and could get us in real trouble.
We're already there. I added, we need to arrest this bastard tonight, before he does whatever he thinks he's going to do next. She didn't say anything, and I thought I'd made my point. All right, let's have the bad news. I added, in a nicer tone, then I can make a rational decision about what to do next. She said,
I thought you may have figured it out by now.
I would have mentioned it if I did. Hold on. I thought for 10 full seconds, and something was trying to connect in my brain, but I had too many things on my mind, so I asked, animal, mineral, or vegetable? She moved to the desk and, still standing, pulled the laptop closer. Let me show you something.
Chapter 45. Kate hit a few keys on the laptop computer, and a page of text came up on the screen. She said, "That's an unpublished piece about Mikhail Putyov, written 10 years ago." I glanced at the screen. "Yeah? And?" She turned the computer toward me and said, "The writer is a fellow named Leonid Chernov, another Russian nuclear physicist, also living in the U.S. This piece is in the form of a letter to fellow physicists, in which he praises Putyov's genius." I didn't respond. She continued, and here, she scrawled, "Chernov writes, and I quote, Putyov is quite content now in his teaching position, and finds his work challenging and rewarding. Though one must ask if he is as challenged as when he worked at the Kurchatov Institute on the Soviet miniaturization program." She looked at me. End quote. Miniaturization of what? Nuclear weapons. Like nuclear artillery shells, for instance, or landmines. Also, nuclear suitcase bombs. It took me half a second to get it, and I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. Holy shit. I stared stupidly at the illuminated laptop screen, my mind racing through everything we'd heard, discovered, knew, and suspected. "John, I think there are 2 nuclear suitcase bombs in Los Angeles and 2 in San Francisco." Holy shit. "I don't know the final destination of those weapons, or if Maddox's 2 aircraft are going to be transporting those suitcases to their ultimate destination or destinations, or if they're going to be put on a ship, or... We need to ground those aircraft." "Done." I called my friend Doug Sturgis, who's the ASAC in the LA field office, and told him to put those 2 aircraft under surveillance in case the pilots show up, or have the planes impounded as evidence in a federal case that was urgent and of the highest priority. I nodded. Her friend, Doug, was, I think, an old boyfriend from when she'd been posted in L.A. some years ago. I'd had the pleasure of meeting this pin dick when Kate and I had chased down Assad Khalil in California, and I had no doubt that this wimp would jump through his ass for his old pal Kate. Still, I didn't see how Kate could kick off a major case with a single phone call to some assistant special agent in charge in L.A. I mean, the workings of the FBI remain a mystery to me, but I seem to recall a chain of command. I asked her about this, and she replied, "What I did, to avoid going through Tom Walsh, was to ask, plead with Doug to treat this as an anonymous terrorist threat tip." She informed me, "That will actually get the ball rolling faster, if Doug says that the tip sounded legitimate." "Right. And he's doing this?" "He said he would." She added, "I explained that I, and you, were having some credibility problems with the ATTF, but that I had this extremely reliable information, and it was urgent, and it was in his jurisdiction, and..." "Okay, I got it. And he's your pal, so he stuck his neck out for you." "He wouldn't stick his neck out for anyone. But he does have to respond to a credible terrorist threat." "Right. I guess he knows you're credible."
"Can we move on?"
"Yeah. I just needed to know that this is in the right hands, and it's not sitting in someone's tomorrow box." She moved on.
"I also gave Doug the names Tim Black and Elwood Bellman, and I told him that Black was probably staying in a hotel in Los Angeles, and Bellman in San Francisco, and that we needed to find these pilots ASAP. She added, I told him my suspicion that they could be transporting suitcase nukes. I nodded. That was the right move, obviously. Did that get his attention? She ignored that and continued, he promised to begin a manhunt in L.A. immediately, and to call the San Francisco field office, and also to put this out to all local law enforcement agencies in both cities and suburbs. He will also speak to his boss in L.A., and both of them will call the directors in charge in New York and Washington, and report this tip. Doug will affirm that he believes it is a credible tip, based on the specific nature of the information and so forth, and he'll describe the actions he's taking. Good. But if this turns out to be 4 suitcases filled with porn magazines from Maddox's Arab friends, will Doug take the rap? Or will he mention your name? She looked at me and asked, do you think I'm wrong on this? I thought a moment, then replied, no, I think you're right. 4 suitcase nukes. I'm with you. Good. Thank you. She continued, I told Doug to ask for an elevated domestic terrorist threat level. That should get the L.A. office off their surfboards. I reminded her, this is not actually a domestic threat.
No.
And Bane Maddox is not a terrorist. Well, maybe he is. But I couldn't figure out how to classify a plot to send 4 suitcase nukes overseas, so I said to Doug, treat it like an elevated domestic threat, as long as we believe the suitcases are still in L.A. and San Francisco. Good move. The FBI in both cities are contacting all the local cab companies to see if any of their drivers remember picking up a male passenger at the taxi line at LAX and SFO, carrying a large, black leather trunk. But I think that's a long shot because, as you know, many of those cabbies are foreigners, and they don't like to talk to the police or FBI.
That was not a politically correct statement from a federal employee, but when the pressure was on, even the feds had to retreat into reality. She continued, we have a better description of the trunks than of the pilots and co-pilots. So I asked Doug to call the FAA and get Black and Bellman's license photos emailed to the FBI in L.A. and San Francisco ASAP. Then I learned, to my amazement, that pilot licenses don't have photos on them. Unbelievable. Another incredible example of FAA post-9/11 stupidity. So I used the FAA addresses for the pilots to get their state driver's licenses with their photos. Black lives in New York, Bellman lives in Connecticut. I see you were busy while I was gone. I got real busy after I realized we may be dealing with suitcase nukes.
Right.
And how is Doug?
I was too busy to ask him. But he did send you his regards.
That's nice. Fuck him. Did he appreciate you telling him how to do his job?
John, I had the information. And I'd been thinking about this, and he was, well, stunned. So, yes, he appreciated my input.
Good. Also, I recalled he seemed dim-witted. I thought about this new and exciting development, and my mind was trying to compute all the angles, equations, and possibilities. I said to Kate, if these pilots went to hotels, and if this is some kind of secret Maddox mission, which it seems to be, then these 4 guys probably checked in under false names. She nodded.
But we have the real names of the 2 pilots, so the FBI will have their driver's license photos very soon, if not already.
She informed me, Doug is asking the Kingston Regional Office in New York to send an agent to the GOCO dispatch office at Stewart Airport to find out who the co-pilots were.
Good thinking.
It seemed that this end of the problem was covered, but I thought that finding those 4 pilots would not be easy, especially if Maddox had instructed them to lay low, not answer their cell phones, stay in their hotel rooms, and use false ID. Kate said,
unfortunately, the suitcase nukes, if that's what they were transporting, could very well be out of their hands by now.
They are suitcase nukes. Just call them what they are.
Okay, okay. Maddox is going to ship them someplace out of the country. My guess is the Mideast, or another Islamic country. She went on. I called Garrett Aviation Service back and got a guy on the phone who said that the Cessna Citation could not make a Pacific crossing unless it went up the west coast to Alaska, then the Aleutian Islands, then Japan, and so forth. She pointed out this would involve many refueling stops, not to mention customs checks along the way. So I think we can rule that out.
I nodded and processed all this. Maddox's Cessna Citations had landed Sunday night in L.A. and San Francisco. The pilots and co-pilots had left no local address, but it indicated that they were flying out Wednesday, tomorrow, and heading back to New York. And I was sure that the pilots thought they were, and maybe they really were. Meanwhile, where was their cargo? Most probably it was not with them any longer. I said to Kate, I'm thinking that Maddox is going to use, or has already used, one of his own oil tankers to transport these nukes someplace. That is why his aircraft landed in seaport cities. Kate nodded.
I came to the same conclusion, and I asked Doug to begin a search of ships and containers at both ports, beginning with GOCO-owned ships. She said, unnecessarily, this is a big job. But if they get the Nest teams activated soon, and the port security people, who also have gamma ray and neutron detectors, we might get lucky.
Right. But they need to sweep not only ships and containers, but also warehouses and trucks. And for all we know, those nukes are going to be shipped by commercial air carriers.
They're also checking all area airports.
Okay. But this really is like looking for a needle in a haystack.
These needles are radioactive, and we have a good chance of finding them.
Maybe, if they're still in L.A. and San Francisco. But here's a more likely scenario. Those nukes are already on their way by sea or air to their final destinations. I mean, it's been almost 2 days since they arrived on the West Coast.
You may be right, but we need to search for them in these cities in case they're still there.
She added, it will be easier to find the pilots, especially if they turn up at LAX and SFO tomorrow.
Right.
Okay, here's the bottom line on those pilots. It would be nice to find them, but I don't think the FBI will find them with their suitcases. The pilots will, however, know where they delivered the suitcases, or maybe who picked them up. But the trail will probably end there. I pointed out, unfortunately, we're about 48 hours late on this, and the next time those suitcase nukes are seen, it will be in the form of 4 mushroom clouds over sandland.
Kate stood silent and motionless for a while. God, I hope not.
Yeah. Well, it seemed that Kate and what's-his-name in L.A. had done all they could on short notice, and they'd done a good job, though this was not rocket science, or nuclear physics, for that matter. It was standard police and FBI work, and it would yield the 4 pilots, and maybe even some information about the suitcase nukes. The problem, however, was, as it had always been with this case, time. Maddox had started the game before the visiting team had even shown up, and he had points on the board before his opponents took the field. But there was possibly good news. A weak link in this nuclear chain. I said to Kate, the ELF transmitter. That is how he is going to detonate those bombs. She nodded. That's what ELF was about. Each bomb must have an extremely low-frequency receiver connected to the detonating device. The ELF waves, as we discovered, can travel around the world and penetrate anything. So when the bombs are where Maddox wants them to be, he sends a code from here, and within an hour, the signal reaches the receivers in the suitcases, wherever in the world they are.
Right.
So it seems as though this asshole built this elaborate ELF station almost 20 years ago to send bogus messages to the U.S. nuclear submarine fleet in order to start World War III. But that didn't work out, so now he's figured out another way to make his investment pay off. Kate nodded and said, "It all makes sense now."
Right. And Putyov was the guy who did whatever he had to do with those suitcase nukes to make them detonate by way of an ELF wave.
Also, I discovered online that miniature nuclear weapons need periodic maintenance, so that was also Putyov's job.
The late Dr. Putyov. Kate nodded.
I asked rhetorically, where the hell did Maddox get these nukes? Then I answered my own question.